Okay, so while we are rebooting here, I should maybe tell you a little bit of what I wanted to do in my talk here today. Actually, as I said, I expected that I would speak at 3:30, so I still had 1.5 hours to work. But nonetheless, I think I'm more or less ready to talk about the things I wanted to talk about. Over the last few years, I would say that in quantum information and quantum optics or atomic physics, we have seen a lot of progress. I would say that in terms of the experimental realization, what we've seen in quantum optics is probably at the very top of what can be done. And so from this point of view, I think when I talk about this quantum information, quantum optics and implementation part, we're actually proud of what happened over the last few years. And I would like to sort of split my talk into two parts. The first part of my talk will be a very simple one. I will talk about the part which is more the quantum computing part, which is more the quantum engineering part, and which is more the part that has to do with, say, ion traps and maybe also cavity QED, optical cavity QED, in the context of Rydberg atoms and quantum gates and atomic ensembles. And talking about this first part, it will be very qualitative. In the second part, I would like to take up something that I normally don't have time to really speak about, which is quantum communication, not for qubits, but it's a different kind of quantum information. It's you will see what it is. It's writing down actually kind of a continuous variable state and talking about teleportation. And it's more a style of doing quantum information, which is not quantum engineering. It's a kind of a quantum gambling, you might say. And whenever you gamble, which means in this case that you do measurements, you have to be very clever that you win. And on the other hand, if you are allowed to gamble and if you do gamble, then quite often the schemes that you do are much simpler. So in the second part of the talk, I really would like to go with you in some detail through some of these ideas that have to do with quantum communication. Which have to do with this quantum communication and the protocol that was recently implemented by Eugene Polzig following one of our ideas to do teleportation with atomic ensembles. And as I said, the second part will be much more complicated, so through the first part I will sort of go very quickly, and I think it will be fairly easy understanding and just following. Okay, so let me start out by sort of setting out what the general goal is. In quantum optics, we have two basic elements. We can play with photons and we can play with atoms. And we have a lot of different techniques of dealing with photons and atoms. If you think about photons, we can put, for example, photons inside of cavities. Or what we can also do is this, that we can use photons, for example, for communications through some fiber. You know, you have some optical fiber and you send a photon through for quantum communication. And on the other hand, we also have in atomic physics, in quantum optics, the atomic part. And all of you, I'm sure, have seen over the last few years these really great experiments that have to do with ion traps or Bose-Einstein condensations, all of the tools for trapping particles, trapping atoms, single atoms, and also, for example, an atomic part have been developed. So I think I'm more or less ready to start now here. I see I wasn't really finished entirely writing the outline when Atta just came upstairs. So this takes a while here. Okay, so this is this tutorial on quantum information, quantum optics, and atomic physics. And let me call it sort of a roadmap here. The goal, what we want to do in quantum optics and atomic physics, sort of can be summarized like this, that we would like to implement what we could call a quantum network. Think of that we have nodes, and we have channels connecting these different nodes, and you should think of these nodes as being little quantum processors. And so we have here quantum processors with atoms that we would like to build. This will afterwards be the models. And we will talk about channels, and we use essentially photons for communication. So the toolbox is photons and atoms, and we would like to connect them together and sort of play kind of a Lego game with these parts here. Well, really what we want to implement in terms of this is the homework we have to do. We want to implement quantum computing in the sense that you have an input state, you have some quantum processor producing an output state, and it means that we have an incoming state here, which is living in this product Hilbert space of the qubits that we have. We want to apply unitary operations to this incoming state, producing then a certain output state followed by some readout. And in quantum communication, the goal is that we have some state phi, and we would like to send it through some, for example, optical fiber from a first person Alice over to Bob. And the reason why this is of interest is Of course, with all of this quantum weirdness like superposition, entanglement, and so on, we've heard many talks about these things already here at the conference, so I don't really have to explain much more. I mean, these are the keywords to be mentioned in this context. So, what we want to do in the case of quantum computing is that we would like to implement, which is written down here, we want qubits, we want single qubit gates, and we want two qubit gates, and the combination of all of these two things, all three things here together, plus then also the readout will be the quantum computer model. So in terms of quantum bits, what we have in mind is that we have n spin 1/2 systems. Each of these spin 1/2 has two levels. We call them usually 0 and 1. And the state of these quantum bits or this quantum register here will be an entangled state. Here's one example that I've written down. The second part that we have to implement is we want to implement single qubit gates. And this means that we just pick out one of these spin 1/2 systems here. Then you want to apply a unitary operation, kind of indicated as here on the right-hand side, where you just talk to one of these qubits here, performing a rotation of the spin 1/2 system. And then we have a two-qubit gate, where we would like to implement an operation that, given a certain control qubit, you would like to act on the target over here, like, for example, this famous control knot that I'm sure most of you have seen before. So most of the work in the following will focus on the discussion in this quantum computing part of how to implement the two-qubit gate. This is the hard part, and this is really where all of the new physics over the last few years has come in. The examples that we have in quantum optics, this is a very incomplete list, but kind of gives it a flavor of things that I will talk about in the following have to do. Well, first of all, there was this ion trap proposal that Ignacio Sirac and myself made a few years ago. And this has led to a lot of experimental work, and I think a tutorial without talking about this, at least very briefly, would be incomplete. So I'll talk about this with a few words. We have thought about, for example, cavity QED implementation, in particular in connection with quantum communication, where you think about qubits represented here by atoms being inside of cavities. You connect them by fibers, and you would like to send quantum information, which is stored in an atom initially, over the fiber via the photon to the other side, storing them again in an atom. Or talking about neutral atoms, we have about a year ago thought about one particular version of a two-qubit gate based on interacting Rydberg dipoles, and I would like to present this today as one example how to do two-qubit gates. And we also had versions like you take what's called an optical lattice, where you take light beams coming from different sides, you make something that could be called like an optical crystal in space, storing atoms at individual sites that can be carrier of the qubits, kind of like indicated over here, and then you try to manipulate them. And the systems that I've listed here, they realize manipulation on the single quantum level. So the computing, quantum computing checklist that we have to then think about sort of goes as follows. First of all, we have to come up with something representing the quantum memory. Then we want a single qubit gate, two qubit gates. This part is sort of the quantum control part that we have to do. And then we have preparation of the initial state and the readout, and we have, this is the part that I would like to call the control decoherence part. And of course, the real decoherence is something that we should avoid as much as we can. So a model has to be developed satisfying all of these ideas that are listed here. And issues that must be discussed is, for example, zero versus finite temperature. Normally in quantum optics, we have zero temperature models that you think about atoms that are cooled to the ground state, or you sort of put the number of photons, they would not have a thermal background and so on. There's this issue of single versus single systems versus ensemble. In quantum optics, we normally speak about single systems, but I'll afterwards speak about ensembles also. Scalability, robustness, speed, simplicity. I think that simplicity is a very important part here. Okay, and experimentalists, of course, will love us for coming up with something which is hopefully relatively simple. And I would say that over the last few years, if I look at the progress that has been made, a lot of it is the fact that schemes, theoretical schemes, have actually become a little bit simpler and less demanding. I would say in quantum optics, we have a very clear answer what quantum memory should be. The answer is simply take long-lived atoms in their ground states. In quantum optics, what has been developed is that we can learn how to take single atoms and trap them inside of a trapping potential. We've learned how to laser cool these atoms down to the, for example, motional ground state here. And these atoms that we sort of keep in free space, these atoms have internal energy levels, like, for example, hyperfine structure ground states, zeros and one here, and they are usually the ideal carriers of qubits. The reason is simply that they're extremely long-lived. And I would say this problem of quantum storage, of quantum memory, is in this context of quantum optics completely solved. Just take an isolated atom, hold it in free space, decoherence is really small. The This is only limited at the moment in the experiments by collisional background rates that you would have, and it's essentially infinite on the time scale relative to the other decoherences that we have.
But it begins with 0 and 1 of the general?
No, it doesn't have to be, no. Normally, quite often they are, no, it doesn't have to be, because you will see in the, you will see in a minute that we will connect them by a laser, and then it's not important at all what these energies are, because the difference will be made up by the laser. And then we have atomic ensembles, ideas like this, that they take a whole bunch of atoms with the idea that they may be easier to control than single ones. And then you can store, for example, qubits by having one of these atoms, you don't say which one it is, transferred into another state. So this would be like the reservoirs of atoms sitting in the state zero. And here would be the ensemble where one of these atoms, we don't know which one it is, would be, say, in the state one. This is sort of an outline of what these trapping ideas are. You know, there's ion traps, like the one that I took here a photo from Rainer Platz. All of these things were developed over the last 15 or 20 years. Here's one example of what Jörg Schmidmeier does in Heidelberg. This is called atomic chip. This is a magnetic trap. We can have far off resonance traps where you simply focus a laser light. And if you focus a laser, then you get an AC star shift, which is seen by the center of mass motion of the atom as a harmonic trapping potential. And so this is what we call a far off resonance trap. This is a laser trap, or in the form of the standing light waves that I mentioned here before, creating what we call an optical lattice. So this is standard in the lab. It's hard, but it's possible. And these traps correspond to conservative potentials. There are techniques for loading the traps. We can laser cool, quite often also to the motional ground states. And the remark has to be made that we have very long coherence times that actually have been demonstrated in the lab. So this is something that exists, and this is sort of the starting point for the whole discussion then. Well, single qubit gates, it's quite obvious how to do single qubit gates in our context. I said before that you have two states, and the fact that the energies are equal here is actually not important. You would like to connect them, for example, by a laser going up and going down. We call this a Raman process, creating an effective Rabi frequencies connecting these two ground states. And the only real difficulty in doing this is the fact that you must assume that with the laser you can address an individual qubit. And experimentally, this is quite often hard in practice. You would like to argue that the atoms should be far apart. But on the other hand, when you think about the two-qubit gates that we'll talk about in the following, you would like the atoms to be close together. So there's a certain compromise, and this addressing part is something which is not always obvious and always easy to do. What about decoherence here? Well, if you are of resonance here with your Raman process and you excite the excited state, there's a certain detuning, and you can see that the optical bumping corresponding to sort of populating the state up here and then followed by spontaneous emission would be given by an effective rate gamma, which scales, however, like 1 over delta square. Delta is the detuning that we have up here relative to the Rabi frequency, which is 1 over delta. So you can see if I go sufficiently far off resonance with my light here, then I will get an effective rate which is much, much less than the good part, which is the Rabi frequency here. So going far off resonance will cure the problem of spontaneous emission. And on the other hand, we can also use this, for example, for, say, preparing a qubit in one particular state, because you just apply a laser, say this one going up, and then you optically bump to one of these states over here. So we have state preparation as the good part of this, and the other part would be decoherence, which in spontaneous emission can be suppressed by simply going very far off resonance. So now comes the real hard part, and this is where I would say all of the thinking has been gone into during the last few years. It's the idea of two qubit gates. What you would like to implement is, for example, something like a phase gate. It's indicated over here by this truth table that if you have two qubits, the first one, the control, the second one, the target, you would like to put the phase, say, on the last one, 1, 1 over here, having an e to I phi, and phi is a phase. For example, you would like to flip a sign over here. This would be an example of what we call a phase gate. The question is how to do it, and there's different versions of doing it. And I would like to bring you two examples that illustrate these two ideas that are behind it. One is the idea of using a collective mode as a data bus. An example for this would be the ion trap. And the other one would be controllable two-body interactions. And the example I would like to discuss for the second part would be the Rydberg quantum gate. And there's two ways always of doing it. You can either use dynamical phases that are accumulated in dynamical process. Sort of you have some energy scales, and then you have an energy and you integrate it over a certain time, accumulating a certain phase phi here. Or you can also do it in the form of geometric phases, like what's called holonomic quantum computing, maybe even some non-abelian Barry's phases. And this has become very popular. To be really honest, I don't really see much advantage or deep advantage in these geometric phases here relative to the dynamical phases. Normally, the argument goes that this is much more robust towards any errors. This is a point that one can discuss in a specific context, but I'm not really sort of the obvious fan of this second approach. Two qubit gates via quantum data bus. This is the first version that we had. And the idea is summarized here as follows. Think that we have qubits here in a quantum register. So this is a spin 1/2 here. And you would like to construct a system where you have a collective mode, indicated over here. It is a collective mode, which is a quantum degree of freedom, like, for example, a harmonic oscillator mode. And this is a collective mode that you would like to couple to the individual qubits. So you would like to have a little switch that allows you to transfer the qubits, the quantum information, sort of swap it on the collective mode. And then by having another little switch over here, you would like to maybe put it here. This is a way of entangling the two atoms. And as I said, examples are the ion traps here, where this would be represented by ions. And the collective mode would simply correspond to the phonons, to the quantized phonons that we have in an ion trap. Or it could also be in cavity QED, where the role of this collective mode is taken up by the photons, either in an optical context or in a microwave context. And tomorrow there will be a talk by Serge Roche talking about the microwave aspects of something related to that. So in a more formal way, you can say what we have here is a system where we have, on one hand, the quantum register, which in our case will be represented by the internal degrees of freedom of our atom, ground state Zeeman coherences between atoms. And on the other hand, the collective mode. And you would like then, using this switching as indicated over here, to write quantum information over to the data bus. And it's collective, so it's connecting all of them and sort of swapping things back and forth and using these kind of ideas to implement the two-qubit gate. The requirement in the form that this is written down here is usually you require for these ideas that the collective mode that you have here is in the ground state. So it's a zero temperature. There are some clever schemes that don't require this, but usually this is one of the requirements. And as a matter of fact, in practice, in the case of an ion trap, this is achieved in practice to within about, I think, 99.something%. The second version would be the two-qubit gate via two-body interaction. And this is, to some extent, maybe the more obvious approach of entangling two atoms. Just based on the fact, think of a qubit sitting here, first atom, second atom. You would like to find an interaction D of R, which is such that you have a Hamiltonian here, that only if the first qubit is in state 1 and the second qubit is in state 1, you would like to switch on as a function of time a certain interaction, delta E of t, in such a way that when you integrate over this interaction, sort of accumulate this for a certain time, you would like to pick up the phase and, for example, put a minus sign over here. What you need for this to happen is this, that it must be controllable, and it must also be state-dependent. And it's not very easy to come up with interactions that satisfy these requirements. Example would be these cold collisions, or what we call the ion trap 2000 proposal, the Rydberg gate idea. And I would like to speak about the last one then in a few minutes. So this was the original idea, and probably was one of the best ones that we ever had in this context, which also led to a lot of experimental work. This was this ion trap quantum computer 95 proposal, together with Ignacio Sirac. But the idea was the following one. In the context of ion traps, people have developed what's called a linear trap. And in a kind of a sketch here, you can see it, what we mean by it. We have a string of ions, which are sitting in a kind of a linear harmonic oscillator potential. Linear in the sense that it is very anisotropic, that you have a string of ions over here that repel each other by the Coulomb repulsion, but they can essentially move along this axis over here, but along the other axis they would be completely confined. And then it's quite obvious, based on what I said before, how you would come up with a quantum computer model in this case, because number one, you would say, well, let's take the internal structure of these ions that we have here as the qubit of our system. So take two hyperfine structure ground states for that, or maybe two Zeeman levels, or maybe some other metastable states representing that. If you want to do single qubit rotations, simply take your laser, address one of these ions. And the fact that typically the distance between them is about, say, 10 micrometers, so really allows you to talk to one of them versus the other one. And this has been achieved actually experimentally. The hard part, as I mentioned, is the question how to do quantum gates between two of these ions. And the idea is here that you have, if you get a string of ions, there will be a collective motion. There will be a center of mass motion, or maybe some stretch mode or some other kind of modes, collective modes, which represent, indicated by these arrows that we have up here. And they are like collective modes of these oscillations of these ions. And you can manipulate them using the laser. And then you can use this as the data bus communicating the qubits here and implementing the quantum gates. So we have here the quantum register, and this is the phonon part. For example, center of mass is this data bus here. And then the quantum computer operations would simply be a time sequence of these laser pulses, and there would be readout of this at the end if you want to make a state measurement by something which in quantum optics is called the method of quantum jumps, which has the nice property that it's 100% efficient. I don't really want to explain exactly how this works. I guess that most of you know this to some extent anyway. The physics behind the gate, let me explain this very qualitatively here, is the following. What you can achieve using a laser is something like this. If you got, for example, a single ion which is sitting inside of a trapping potential, and you want to drive it with a laser, and you drive it from one internal state to another one, there will be a momentum kick associated with this photon absorption. It's very clear. If I absorb a photon, okay, from the laser, there will be a momentum kick. And this allows one to, so to say, by making internal transitions between internal levels via, by the laser, to couple to the center of mass. And if you look at it a little bit more closely, then you will find that we have here that we can implement an idea like this. If you have an atomic part and you have your two, and you get your state as a superposition between the zero and one, and you got your phonon state, for example, this will be the center of mass motions and of all of these ions here. Using laser processes, which are cleverly designed, you can essentially swap this part over here, this unknown superposition, over to the phonon part. So this is the part where you kind of put the qubit onto the data bus and make it available to all of the other ions which are sitting there. And then the qubit gate sort of works in a combination like this. You would go, for example, with your laser, one of the ions, do exactly the swap operation that we have over here. So you swap the qubit number one to the phononic data bus, for example. So the ion over here is now in one internal state, and this qubit is now written into the motion. And then you can go to the second one. For example, at this point, this qubit over here has, first of all, the internal qubit represented, plus also then in the motion, the qubit that used to be over here. And then using some appropriate pulse sequence, you can quite easily, for example, flip certain signs here. And then at the end, what you want to do is this, that of course you want to write the qubit back to where it really belonged, putting this thing back here. And so by combining ideas like this, at the end of the day, what you find is that you can put certain phases there that, for example, correspond to a phase gate, what you want to implement. There have been a lot of experiments. Here's one from my colleague Rainer Platt at Innsbruck, and here's sort of the achievements over the last few years. They're very close to doing a two-qubit quantum gate. All of these pieces work separately, but they've never worked collectively. Here's this nice photograph that shows this string of ions. This is, so to say, is your quantum register, you might say. You can very clearly see the distance between these ions here, and this is how the ion trap that we have up there really looks like. So this is a true picture of a of your quantum register as carrier of the qubit here. And of course, the most successful group has been the one by Dave Wineland. And I would say that the highlights, for example, was last year this famous paper in Nature, where they produced ideas like this, actually in the protocol, which is due to Möllmann and Sørensen, these maximally entangled states of four of these qubits. So they had four ions here, and then they produced a state like this, which is what we call a maximally entangled state. And they have, in the meantime, done also Bell state measurements and two-atom entangled states based on interferometer and so on. So there's a whole series of experiments that started out sort of from this original idea of ion trap quantum computing. At the moment, this is not really quantum computing here, very clearly, but it's sort of demonstrating the basic elements of this entanglement in experiments. Let me now come to the second example of how to do quantum gates. As I said before, the first example was we had this data bus idea. Now let me show you an example where we would like to manipulate kind of a controlled two-body interactions between atoms. And in particular, in the case of neutral atoms, there's a big problem here. Because if I give you Like if you atoms that don't have a charge, like in the case of an ion, where they would be somehow oscillating in a collective mode, even if the distance between them is relatively large, it's very hard to come up with good ideas for neutral atoms, how to entangle them. And there's some obvious ideas, like for example, you could take an atom and simply move it close to the other one to maybe do some kind of a collision, and we've thought about these things and worked it out. The major complaint always remains that it's something which at the end is very slow. Okay, and of course you can argue that decoherence with the neutral atoms is very good, so you might say we can afford to be slow, and maybe at the moment speed is not the issue anyway, but nonetheless it's very slow. But here's one example, which is this Rydberg gate with Rydberg atoms, which is very fast, and I think at the moment this is probably for the neutral atoms, apart from cavity QED now, one of the best ideas, I would say, on the market. People are trying to work on this at the moment, but the experimental demonstration, of course, is not here yet. So what's the idea? I can explain the physics very simple within a few words. Think of an atom being an electric field. And think of what you learned in your quantum mechanics one lecture. What happens to a Rydberg atom that you put in a Stark field? If you go to one of the Rydberg states, there will be something that we call the linear Stark effect, and there will be this Stark map going out here, and the splitting will be linear with the electric field. That's the reason why we call it linear. And so if I go from the ground state and excite one of these Rydberg states up here, and for example, I would take the outermost one that I've indicated over here, there would be an enormous permanent dipole associated with this atom, because it's like a big charge separation that I have there, and there would be an enormous dipole moment. And you can see that the dipole moment scales like n squared, and n is the principal quantum number that we're going up in the series. To give you one example, that this is really huge numbers. Think of two atoms that are somehow close together, like in an optical lattice, so this distance would be of the order of an optical wavelength. And if you take two of these dipoles for the fairly moderate value of n equal to 15, you could go much higher here, you would get an energy, you would get the dipole-dipole interaction between these two dipoles that we have here of the order of about 4 gigahertz. Okay, that's very, very fast. If you think of, for example, some other processes that we have for neutral atoms would be more on the time scale of maybe 10 kilohertz or something like that. So that's really fast. And I would say that's a very good argument where some of these ideas might actually work in practice and be useful. So to give you then a feeling of how the two-qubit gate dynamics would work in this particular example, let's look at this case a little bit more closely. We have here an atom number one and an atom number two, and as I mentioned before, think of these atoms being separated by maybe something like an optical wavelength or half an optical wavelength, like you would typically have in an optical lattice configuration. And then you would store again, this is the philosophy that I pointed out before, the qubit in the ground state, 0, 1, and then also 0, 1 over here. And then using laser selection rules, what you want to do is this, that you would like to switch on this strong interaction that corresponds to these interacting dipoles with the help of the laser, and you would like to switch it on in a selective way. So using selection rule arguments, you want to excite here the ground state 0 up to the state R, and you can see that if you are here in 0 as well as 0 over here, then you would populate the excited state here, and then the truth table would be something like this here. If you're in the state 1, nothing happens because the laser doesn't touch it, so you stay in the green one. But for example, if the left one is 1, you would make here nothing, the right one would be 0, you make here a dipole, and you can immediately see that in the part that we have down here, there would be a very large dipole-dipole interaction. And this is the gigahertz scale that I talked about here before. But at the same time, we can also see that, well, it's in this sense where we might be able to create now very large interactions between these dipoles in this sense here. And you might say, well, that's great, so we have a quantum gate here that works on the gigahertz time scale. But actually, the situation is not so simple. We should not forget, for example, that if you switch on these really strong interactions, what will happen to these atoms that are actually sitting in trapping potential is that these atoms will start moving. So in other words, you start entangling the motion of the atom with the qubit. And once this happens, then of course what will happen is this, that you have decoherence, because the motion is something that which you have to trace out at the very end. So there will be a force, and this force causes decoherence, and you have gained not very much. So we have to complement this idea with something that tells us how to do a scheme where actually you benefit from this very large interaction without ever exciting the state. So to say you would like to get rid of the force completely. To some extent, you might say, well, that's impossible, because you know, if you just want to use the doubly excited state, for this, but here's one scheme that sort of indicates what the idea is. Let's look at the situation now, and I've sort of plotted now, this is finally the truth table that we have for the quantum gate, And I've plotted now this energy excitation spectrum for two atoms. So for example, if I'm in a state 0, 0, this means that the first atom is in 0, the second one is in 0. And if I would shine a laser on the first atom, I would take the electron and put it up by making out of the 0, for example, this first state R. This is the Rydberg state. So this is the first atom excited to the Rydberg state. And if I would take now a second laser, I would sort of lift this second electron, which is now sitting in the ground, say the right one, with the laser omega 2 again to this Rydberg state up here. But now you can see what's happening here is this, that when two atoms are in the Rydberg state, there will be this enormous dipole-dipole interaction. So the position of this doubly excited state RR is not where we expect it to be from the bare atom. It will actually be shifted a lot, sort of reminiscent of what we have in a Coulomb blockade system in a quantum dot. And we call this here a dipole-dipole blockade in the following. So there's a very large dipole-dipole interaction that shifts this resonance out there. And the idea is now to design a process for the quantum gate that actually never populates the doubly excited state and in this sense getting rid of the force while at the same time getting the right truth table for these atoms. So a particular laser sequence, for example, could be pi, 2 pi, and then pi. And let me just go through the various steps now, showing you how this might work, giving you a feeling for that. So if I go to the first atom and I apply a pi pulse, then what I will do is this, that I take the electron from the zero here, lift it up to the state R, so I'm sort of halfway up here. And also here, I would go from zero up to the state R. And then I go to the second atom, and I do a 2 pi pulse here. And then you can see what's happening is this, that in the 2 pi pulse, this electron will stay up here where it was on the left atom, but the other one sort of has come down. And you can see that with this omega 2, this is a 2 pi pulse. What we have gained at this point is that we have flipped a spin, done a complete rotation, so we have picked up a minus sign here. So here we got a minus sign, which is already here, will be part of the truth table that we write down at the end. But what happens to the electron, part of the electron wave function, which sits, for example, here, where we had the R0? In this case, you would like to take now the second atom over here, and you would like to do your flopping, your spin rotation. But now you can see that the dipole-dipole shift has moved this energy level very far up resonance. So you can see that actually nothing will happen here. This electron will simply stay here as it was, because the level is so far up resonance that it doesn't see the level, so it will simply do nothing. So you can see that we got here no change of sign, and here we got this minus sign already. And then at the very end, you put another pi pulse here. You would like to sort of go over these things. You would like to put everything back. And you can see that we put this back, putting a minus sign here. Here we already got the minus sign from before, and now we put this back to the ground state, and we got one up and one down. The up here was not allowed, again making a minus sign. Then you have a truth table indicated here. You got minus, 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 and then only for the one state over here that was never touched, you get a plus over here. You get a plus over here. So apart from a global phase, which is of course irrelevant, this is just the truth table that we had for the phase case that I mentioned before. Okay, very briefly, a few words about atomic ensembles. Ideas like this can be translated into atomic ensembles. And the idea in atomic ensembles is that think of maybe a few atoms. We don't want to control single ones because this is experimentally very hard to do. Say a bunch of maybe about 100 atoms confined to a volume, like in a far-off resonance trap of about, say, 10 micrometer. And then you want to use the underlying physics that I just explained, namely the dipole blockade mechanism, where you have this whole reservoir of atoms in the ground state, and then you would like to make a laser process where you take an atom out over here. You don't address the atoms individually. You just, I mean, talk to all of them at the same time. And you would like to put one of them, you don't know which one it is, over here into the state Q. And the way that we can achieve it is now exactly making use of this dipole blockade mechanism that I pointed out in the case of the Rydberg gate. So you would have a process like this, that you have a ground state here, all of these atoms sitting in the ground state, and then you want to take now one of them out. And you can see what's happening is, if I excite a single atom, I can put it into the Rydberg state here, but I will never able to find a process where I put two at the same time. And the reason why we don't get two at the same time is this dipole-dipole blockade mechanism that shifts these energy levels so far of resonance. So if I have sort of selectively excited a single atom, I have it up here, then I can bring it down to this other level. And now you can see that we have the possibilities of counting individual levels. So it's like in a dipole blockade mechanism, in a Coulomb blockade mechanism with a quantum dot. These ideas can be developed. You can store here single excitations in the whole atomic ensemble in the sense of a symmetric configuration, as you write down here. You can see that we don't know which of these atoms is excited in the state Q. It is one of them, so you excite a symmetric combination of that. And then ideas like storing qubits in this case would be like having this reservoir and then having one of them excited. And then also entanglement between ensembles would be having two of these atoms in these Rydberg states, and then there would be interactions. And the argument would be very similar to before. The only difference would be the fact that, of course, the distance between these atoms here would be much larger, though the requirements would be actually much stronger. So on one hand, this is easier. On the other hand, it's a little bit more difficult. But I think that ideas along these lines might actually stimulate during the next few years some work on atomic ensembles, just in this sense as it is indicated here. I should also mention that there's been a whole class of experiments around in the last year or something like this that have to do with atomic ensembles, but as a quantum memory of light. And the idea there is the following one, that think of some light pulse which is coming in. And the goal is then that you have an atomic ensemble, and you want to use this atomic ensemble as a storage medium. So you want to absorb all of these atoms, all of these photons that are coming in completely into the atoms, and then you want to store this quantum superposition of your light pulse that you have here in the atomic ensemble. Here's one example that you would take a cavity here. You got atoms waiting inside here, so this would be a reservoir state. And every photon that comes in is absorbed, and then you use a laser, for example, to put it in one of the other states. So in this sense, there's a one-to-one mapping between the quantum state of the light field that you have and then the atomic ensembles. And there have been experiments and also corresponding theory done along these lines. And of course, this is orders of magnitude simpler than storing qubits in single atoms. Okay, if you read one of the next issues of Nature, then you will find that there's a paper, an experimental paper by Eugene Polzig there that talks about teleportation with coherent light and atomic ensembles. And I would like to spend the rest of my time now here that I have, it's a little bit less than half an hour, explaining you really in some detail what in this new class of experiments is going on. Because I think that many of you have heard the first part of my talk, bits and pieces there, maybe about ion traps and cavity QED and so on. But these are somehow new ideas here, and where you try to make entanglement based on measurements. And we don't talk about qubits, we talk about what's called the continuous variable quantum states or quantum communication. And so I would like to really go in a little bit more detail explaining what's going on in these experiments and showing you to what extent one can do, for example, teleportation. So this is the second part of my talk about quantum communication and more about quantum gambling rather than quantum engineering, because we're going to use measurement. So the basic underlying philosophy that we have is this, that so far what I've talked about is we have spoken about single atoms and single photons, that we have talked about high Q cavities. And so what we had in mind, for example, if you would draw a cavity QED analog, is single atoms inside of high Q cavities. We talk about single atoms, single photons, and you want very high Q cavities in order to make all of these coherent manipulations on the single photon and atom level. So the question is now, can we get away with something which is orders of magnitude more simpler, like taking a whole ensemble of atoms, and then instead of, for example, having a cavity, why not use free space? So atomic ensemble free space, and we're going to use now measurements in order to produce now, for example, EPR correlations for quantum communication. So this indicates here what we mean by quantum communication. In the goal in quantum communication is this, that you have Alice, and you have Bob over here, and you want Alice to send a quantum state that we call phi, it's an unknown quantum state, through some channel that we have over to the right-hand side to Bob. That's a transmission of the quantum state, and it can either be a qubit, like a superposition of 0 and 1, or it could also be a wave function, like the wave function written here. This is psi of x, and think of x and p in the following as a position and a momentum operator, satisfying the canonical commutation relations. So in the following, we will ask the goal that you have some wave function, in the sense of the second case, the continuous variable quantum system, and you would like to send it over, and we're going to send it over using teleportation. And the important point about using atomic ensembles in the following will be the fact also that in these experiments, the quantum states can be kept in the atoms for a very long time. Normally in these photon experiments, it's very difficult to store photons for an appreciable amount of time, but atoms are really good quantum memory. So to some extent, what we do is this, that we talk about experiments that have been done in a somewhat different context with photons, but we want to do it now with atoms, getting this benefit of this quantum memory aspect. So how does this teleportation with continuous variable states work? This is ideas that go back to Weidmann, Brownstein, and Kimball were the first ones to put this into the context of quantum optics. And there's an experiment by Kimball a few years ago that has demonstrated this for the first time. So again, as I said before, you have a continuous variable quantum state indicated over here. You get position and momentum. I mean, what's important is only that you have canonical commutation relation. And in the following, for example, this could be the quadrature components of a light field, or it could also be, for example, a certain component of some spin state. And we'll talk about atomic ensembles in the following representing that, actually. And then we have a continuous variable protocol for teleportation, which works essentially something like this. If you take these two parties, this is Alice and Bob, the first part in the teleportation protocol is always that you want to generate an EPR pair. And so you should note that you got the unknown quantum state that you would like to send over to the other side, stored in what we call here T. So in the case of a qubit, this would be a single atom sitting over here. And that what you prepare is a resource, which is the EPR state. And in the case of the continuous variable quantum system, you want an EPR state, which is really exactly the one which was written down by Einstein, Podolsky, Rosen originally when they talked about EPR paradoxes. Namely, it is a state where you have the momentum anticorrelated, or which is equal to the position which is entirely correlated. And of course, to be physical, there should be a certain cutoff over here. Otherwise, it would be an infinite energy state. But the way that this is written down here at the moment, you should note that this EPR state is an eigenstate of the commuting operators, where we have xA minus xB and the PA plus the PB here. And these are eigenstate, they are commuting operators. And the eigenstate of these two operators is exactly what we have up here. So you should note, of course, because this being an eigenstate, we should understand that the variance in this eigenstate, when you let this energy go to infinity, this energy cutoff, which is implicit up here, that this variance will go to zero here. So if you have a state like this, then you can teleport, and the teleportation protocol is something like this. That you have initially the incoming state, which is the quantum state, which is stored in this quantum system that we call T over here, and then you got an EPR state. And then on the left-hand side, you make what's called a Bell measurement. And the Bell measurement means that you make a simultaneous measurement of the two commuting operator, which is this xt minus xa, and the pt plus the pa. And then as a result of doing these two measurements, which in the case of optics can be done using, for example, some beam splitters, and we'll show you afterwards how we do it in our case now here, you get some readout values x2 and p2. This is the result of the Bell measurement that you had to. And then knowing these results, you can, of course, now write down what the state is that you have for this joint quantum system here due to the fact that we have made a measurement. Due to the fact of having made a measurement, the out state that we have here is the one where on the left-hand side, you have just projected into one of these EPR states, you made these measurements over here. This is x2, p2 here. But on the right-hand side, we have a state psi in that we have to work now out by putting the projection on from the measurement that we have over here. And if you work it out, a few lines, you will find that Bob now has exactly the state that we put in on the left-hand side. It is this unknown quantum state psi that we had here, but it is shifted by these values. So if there's a classical communication, you can undo the shift. You know, this is like a coherent state displacement P and X that we have here. You can undo the shift, and if you undo this part by first having classical communication and then applying this displacement operator, you can see that we get on the right-hand side the unknown quantum state. This is continuous variable quantum teleportation as invented first by Weidmann, and then, as I said, Brownstein and Kimball were the ones that put it first into quantum optics. Now, an example of a physical realization of this teleportation is the one that goes back again to Brownstein and Kimball. I think in a pretty good paper that he wrote a few years ago, and then there was afterwards this experiment, but he pointed out that an EPR state of the sort that we've been talking about is realized in the context of squeezed light. Let me tell you what the squeezed vacuum is. If you have some nonlinear process, like having some pump, laser, you get two beams out, let me call them A and B, like in parametric down conversion. And if you write down the corresponding quantum state in a system like this, It would be a state where you have here is the vacuum of the two modes that we call here A and B. And then it would simply be an e to the r. R is what we call a squeezing parameter. It depends on your interaction time. It's an a dagger b dagger minus an ab. And if you write this out in the number basis, you can see why we call this an EPR state. We can see that the number of photons in one arm, which is the a mode, is equal to the number of photons in the other arm. So if you write it out, you have sort of a 0, 0 plus a 1, plus, 1, 1 plus a 2, 2, and so on going on. Which, of course, is just a maximally entangled state or something which is, you know, if you let this parameter r go into infinity, it would be a maximally entangled state in this infinite Hilbert space. So if I rewrite what we have over here in terms of what we call the quadrature component, which you should think in the case of radiation field as simply being the in-phase and the out-phase component of the light field, then we can say that the destruction operator A of the light field can be written as an X plus an IP. And of course, X and P now correspond to two canonical conjugated operators. So we have canonical commutation relations. X commutated with a P is equal to 1. So we have here a system where we have canonical commutation relations. And the physical realization is that they correspond to the quadrature components of light. And now you can rewrite the state that we have up here in this kind of a position representation, you might call it, of these xA and xB. And what you will find is that the resulting wave function will be like a Gaussian here, and an xA plus xB, and then an xA minus xB. And the what we call the squeezing parameter up here would just correspond to the variance of this. So if you work it out, you find that the variance of xA minus xB and the variance of the PA plus PB is just exponentially small with its squeezing parameter. So this is a very good approximation to the EPR state that we talked about before. So in the case of the Caltech experiment, then the whole teleportation works as follows. Then you have an EPR source, which is parametric down conversion, and you produce now two beams that we call 1 and 2. And the quantum variables in this case are the quadrature components, and the EPR correlations is the light squeezing. What we will talk about in the following is more a scheme like this. We're going to talk about atoms here, and there will be a whole atomic ensemble, and there will be a second atomic ensemble here. And what we will do is this, that we take coherent light, and we will shine this coherent light through these atomic ensembles over here, and we'll make a measurement. And the idea will be that by making the measurement on the right-hand side, what will happen is this, that you project these two atomic ensembles into a superposition state here, which corresponds to this EPR state that we want to generate. So we have a way of generating EPR correlations by making an appropriate measurement, and by the measurement you project into this EPR state that we want. So the carrier in this case is no longer the quadrature component, but there will be an atomic collective spin which now represents the quantum state, and it will take me some time to explain to you what we mean by that. And instead of the light squeezing, we have now here the spin squeezing. And the question is, of course, what's the interaction, the noise? Does this work better than maybe the light part? And our argument is that with atoms, these things typically do work better. So we believe that this might be a better implementation experimentally than the original idea using light. And then there's always a second part, which I mentioned before, is this Bell measurement. In the case of this Caltech experiment, it was the light going out here. This was the incoming one that you wanted to teleport. And the Bell measurement would be implemented just by some beam splitter here. You would read out the two measurement values here. Then there would be classical communication over here, then displacing the corresponding quantum state. In our case, it would now simply mean that we have two ensembles where we had the EPR correlations. You take an extra one that has now the quantum state that you want to teleport encoded. And so already here we have the EPR correlation, and then again using coherent light, you can make a very similar measurement and then do a teleportation, which is, if you write down the mathematics, it's completely identical in both cases. There's questions like efficiency and so on, and one can argue that maybe this works better than in the case of atoms. So I would like to tell you now in the following a little bit the physics behind these ideas, because maybe some of you are not so familiar what it means to store, for example, a continuous variable state in an atomic ensemble and so on, which is really quite in contrast to the qubits that we talk about when we think of single atoms and so on. So this will maybe take a little bit of explaining. So let's start out again with atomic physics. What we will discuss now in the following is an interaction like the one indicated here. We have an atomic ensemble, and have in mind that this could be some atoms in some gas cells. They don't really have to be very cold. But we would like to have then an environment where the collisions are not strong enough to destroy, for example, ground state coherences. And we will then take coherent light with a linear light polarization, and we would like to send this light here through the atoms. Now, let's write down a specific atomic level configuration in this case. What we will have is this, that we have, for example, an J equal to 1/2 to 1/2 transition in an atom. And you would have two ground states here. I call them 1 and 2. And I will actually prepare this ground state here in such a way that I would like, by some appropriate pivot 2 pulse, each of these atoms in this whole ensemble to be in the superposition state of 1 and 2. So it's like 1 plus 2 and then to the power n. This will be a product state, and we're going to use then this state and the following as a reference state for this process. So initially, we are in a superposition state of these two ground states over here. Now, if the light field that we have here, the coherent light, comes in, and we would like to detune this light a little bit from the upper state here, if it is a linearly polarized light, you can see that we can always decompose it into a sigma plus and into a sigma minus component. So what will happen is here that you can see that the sigma plus component will act on the state here, because this will couple the 1 state here to the 4 state, and it will couple here the 2 state up to the state number 3. And there will be corresponding star shifts. For example, this state will be shifted down, and this state will be shifted down, depending on the amplitude that you have. But you can see that if you have a very slight imbalance of your light polarizations, and we will use this in the following as our quantum variable, then there will be corresponding fluctuations, quantum noise fluctuations, between the state 1 and 2. And this will be the physics in the following, and we will now go through various steps trying to understand what this dynamics is. So to summarize this in one sentence, atoms which are in the superposition state of the two ground states, and we have light that we shine in, a coherent light which is linearly polarized. What's the coherence in this case? Well, it would be that spontaneous emission, which has to be taken into account at the end if you do a proper analysis of what the noise properties are in a process like this. Okay, so step number one is this, that we have to try to understand what it means that atoms are a quantum system representing a continuous variable system. So what do we mean by this? Well, if I have a whole atomic ensemble, I can take a certain slice out of this atomic ensemble and simply write down or sort of count all of the atoms, which are this little slice over here, and write down an operator, which is now a raising operator that takes me from some maybe atomic level nu to some level mu over here. The index I is the atom number I that we have. And if you add up all of these atoms that you have in this little slice over here with a certain density, and this delta z is just the length here of the slice that we have, then you can define operator sigma. So think of these operators like being local creation or destruction operators transferring atoms between two states nu and mu at the given position z. And then we can define now collective spin operators, and I think that most of you are of course familiar with this Bloch vector. This is kind of a quantum version of this. If I take the ground state polarization like the 1, 2, this was the two ground states of the system that we had, and I form the sigma 1, 2 and the sigma 1, 2 dagger, and integrate this over the whole slice of atoms over here, I can call this an operator SX, and I put the label A for atom over here. And I can do something very similar for a Y component, which is just the imaginary part of this, or then a Z component, which is just the population difference between the two ground states. And it's a very simple exercise to check that the computation relations that we have in the case for these three operators is just angular momentum. So you can see, of course, an ensemble of atoms with internal structure, we have two ground states, 1 and 2, they just correspond to angular momentum. So how do we make out of an angular momentum now something which is like canonical commutation relations in the continuous variable quantum system? So let me go over the steps now in some detail. As I mentioned before, what we want to start out with at the very beginning is that we have the two ground states, 1 and 2, and you would like to put them into a superposition state of 1 plus 2. And we got n atoms, so you got this thing n times, so it's 1 plus 2 here to the power n. This is the initial state that we prepare the atoms in before the light comes. If I take the particular state that I've written down here, and I take the Bloch vector that I had before, this angular momentum pseudo vector, and I work out the expectation value of this, there will be an x component in this particular state, a y component, and a z component. And for this case that we write up here with this 1 plus 2, it is a case where we have the number of atoms divided by 2 in the x component, but we got 0 in the other one. So the expectation value of this Bloch vector in this particular state would be a very long vector pointing along the x-axis. So this is indicated on the right-hand side over here. This is the Bloch vector picture. But now what we're interested in is this, that we would like to look at quantum fluctuations. So we would like to look at this Bloch vector. This is the mean value. And now we would like to look at small quantum fluctuations around it. How do we describe that? Well, if you write down the commutation relation between the y and the z component, of course, angular momentum relations tell you that this is equal to x. And of course, there is a corresponding uncertainty relation like the one which is written here. Now, if you take states that are very close to the product state that we have up here, sort of states that are very close around this mean value here, then you can see that we can argue that we can replace the Sx value on the right-hand side essentially by its expectation value up here. It's like kind of linearizing, if you want, your commutation relation for this particular class of states that we would like to look at. And if you normalize this, you can see that the y and the z component becomes now an x and a p. And we have written down here canonical commutation relations, and we have sort of stored, if you want, continuous variable quantum states in internal superposition states of the whole atomic ensemble. And the key idea is simply we have replaced the angular momentum commutation relation in this kind of linearized approximation here by this canonical one. The right-hand side is now replaced by the classical mean value. And to give you some pictorial understanding of this, this is, so to say, the original state that we had here. And I've drawn here the uncertainty of this state, because it turns out that this state here in our representation can be written like a wave function. And the x is now exactly this position operator, under quote. And the original state up here is like a Gaussian. So it's like the vacuum state, if you want. And you take any other state out here. So this is like a quasi-probability distribution, if you want, of states that sort of live around the state over here. So you can see that we have now angular momentum in this collective angular momentum in our system representing continuous variable states. And the whole idea was very simple, just linearize the commutation relation. Now, with light polarization, I can argue very similarly. Okay, again, we would like to get something which is like angular momentum, but then you would like to linearize to some extent again to get, again, in light polarization, stored something which is a continuous variable quantum state. So here's written down the usual things. This is the light propagation direction. I call Ex. This is initially the coherent light, the light polarization. And I write down the field operator for the electric field, which is here just the usual mode functions. And then I have here the two components, I, that represents the sigma plus and the sigma minus component of the light propagating along this direction. And I will have the normal commutation relations for this electric field component here. But now I can define something which we call the Stokes parameter. And the Stokes parameter is simply writing down the Schwinger representation of angular momentum that it can build out of these two lowering operators, A1 and A2, for these modes representing the sigma plus and the sigma minus component. Okay? So if you take these two, you can write down, again, that we have an x and a y and a z component. And this Stokes vector simply is an angular momentum operator, okay, representing the light polarization. What will happen now if I take now the input light that I had here before, and this input light that we had here is now in a coherent state with some linear light polarization? What will happen is this, that the expectation value of this particular state here with this AI is simply some large coherent component corresponding to a certain number of photons that you have in your whole wave packet. And when you take it, you can now do a similar argument to what we had before, namely you take your Stokes vector representing the light fluctuations. And you can write down again, you know, commutation relations between the y and the z representing the x. And of course, what I want to do is, again, that I would like to linearize here, getting out that the mean expectation value of my Stokes vector, now for the photon, represents the number of photons divided by 2. Okay, it's completely parallel to what we had before in the case of an atom. And then in the case here, we have here that we have x and p commutation relations equal to the I. And then you can write down a corresponding wave function, again, representing now the quantum state encoded into the polarization fluctuations of this light like in the picture that we had here before. So there's a complete parallelism between atoms and photons. In one case, we talk about internal states for the atoms. In the other case, we talk about light polarization fluctuations around coherent light state, and you have some fluctuations of this linear light polarization. Okay, so let's now try to combine these two pictures here together to get some dynamics. How does it work? Well, in principle, what we have to solve is a quantum noise propagation problem. And this is, of course, very hard. We're going to replace it by something a little bit simpler very soon. But we have a first atomic ensemble and a second one, and we have this coherent light which is propagating through, and we would like to describe it. Well, we know how to do, in principle, quantum noise propagation problems by essentially writing down a set of Maxwell Bloch equations, like the one indicated here for this sigma plus and the sigma minus component for these operators. And similarly, one here for the ground state coherences that we have. This is the sigma 1, 2, representing the ground state coherence between these atoms that we have. So what's the physics now behind it? You can see that we have some noise terms over here that I haven't even bothered to write down. There will be some damping terms. Let's concentrate on the essential part over here, which is the part contained in here. The essential physics behind it can be sort of seen. Look at the atomic part here. This is the sigma 1, 2 and the sigma 1, 2. And you can see that the difference in the polarization between the sigma plus and the sigma minus component of the photons. This is the slight imbalance that we had in our light polarization. This is the one that couples to the sigma 1, 2 component. We can see that if you have a slight imbalance of the amplitude of sigma plus and sigma minus, you get a very slightly different kind of dispersion of the two ground states. You will get a little bit of different shifts, and this little bit different shift will be like a phase modulation of sigma 1, 2. In a similar way, you can think that the A, this is the sort of back reaction, would correspond to an index of refraction which is coupled to the population of these two states. And if you only take this coherent part out for the moment and ignore noise, you can see that essentially the interaction that we have is this, that we have a Hamiltonian, which can now be written as a coupling of the Stokes vector of the atomic part, okay, this was the collective angular momentum Stokes vector, coupled to the photon light polarization vector. So we have two angular momenta that couple together. And if you linearize, essentially what it means is this, that the H that you have here is like a PP coupling. So it's like a momentum-momentum coupling, if you want to. This is really what this light polarization corresponds to. So the next step is this, that you would like to simplify it. You know, we had the light propagation problem. And now, in principle, you should really propagate the light. Essentially, what we do is kind of a mean field approximation, but in a spatial sense, that we sort of take an average over the whole atomic ensemble. And then we would like to write down a theory like this, where we take the average here in a spatial sense of this ensemble, and then we have now operators XP and operators PP representing now the quantum noise fluctuations here of the polarization of the photons, and the propagation through the atomic medium is nothing else but simply multiplying this thing in the Heisenberg sense by some effective time of evolution operator, which is nothing else but just the PP interaction that we had before. So you can see that we're just back to a one-dimensional problem. You got X and P for the photon, and we just got some Hamiltonian time evolution, which is of the form like a PP interaction here. And this was first written down by Kuzmitz and Boltzig, and this is part of the scheme that we're going to use. So the system of the whole process that we would like to describe then is something like this. Coherent light propagates through these ensembles, and we're going to model this by this kind of effective PP quadratic coupling. And we can describe this either in the Heisenberg or the Schrödinger picture. And I think I just have time to talk about the Heisenberg picture part and the Schrödinger picture part. If somebody wants to see it, I can sort of show that afterwards. What's the idea here? Well, let's talk again about the physics which is contained in this now. So we have now an input light field, and we have an output light field. And we said before that we have a coherent part of the light component, okay, and we want to talk about very small polarization fluctuations around it represented by X and P. And then we had an atomic part, we put the atoms into a superposition of states, and again we were talking about very small deviations from this superposition state, again represented by an X and a P. So how do these things now interact? So if I send in some light, X and P, this is the operator corresponding to these polarization fluctuations. They are propagated according to this, that we get this Heisenberg time evolution here with this effective Hamiltonian. It's written down here. And if you write it down, then you find out this is what we call in quantum optics a Q&D interaction. So it's like a light propagating X prime and P prime. And you can see that for the specific interaction that we have here, there will be a coupling where the P component is not changed, But the X component of the incoming light polarization, this is the one that we have from the left, you write the atomic part on top of this thing. So you can see that we have written the atomic quantum noise on the polarization of the X component at the output. And in a very similar way, you would have here the X component of the atomic system, and you have written the noise component that you have in the polarization of the light field, and you have written it on it, but the corresponding P component is completely unaffected. So this is a very specific coupling, and we'll see now in a minute how this very specific coupling will allow us to do by measurement exactly to produce EPR states. So teleportation step number one then, sort of indicated in this qualitative feature that I've only time here to discuss, would be something like this. I have light that has light fluctuations, XP, that go in here, propagating through the first atomic ensemble, and then you have the second atomic ensemble, and then you would like to do a measurement at the end. Okay, what will happen? Well, the outputs that I have over here, this is the X prime. I have to apply now two time evolution operators to that, corresponding to propagation to the first and the second atomic ensembles. And you can see what will happen is this, that the outgoing light beam has a light fluctuation corresponding to the incident one, which in our case is just a vacuum noise. So look at this like sort of a random force, but now represented by this operator. And we have written on top of this the sum of the two P components. So I think it's intuitively at this point actually quite clear that if I argue that I want to measure now over here this operator X prime, what will happen is this, that if I measure this, essentially what I do is I make a projective measurement of P plus P with a little bit of noise on top. Okay? What does it mean to make a measurement of P plus P? I mean, if I project to an eigenstate, this is just one of the EPR states that we wanted to have. So you can see now what the logic is behind it. By measuring the output light polarization fluctuation, provided that this term kappa, which is an interaction strength, is very large, you can argue that the first term here is in vacuum noise is small, you project into an eigenstate of P plus P. So by projecting into an eigenstate of P plus P, you've made an EPR state. So you can simply sit down and do all of these calculations and find at the end that this parameter kappa that we have is like an effective squeezing parameter, and what you have produced is sort of an EPR state by making exactly this kind of measurement. So the conclusion is, if I send light, strong coherent light, through an atomic ensemble prepared in a superposition state, at the end I will have projected, by doing this measurement, everything into the into an EPR state of the atomic ensembles. You can do this also then in a second step, where you want to measure X minus X here, and at the end of the day what you get is just that the variances, the fluctuations, correspond to these kind of interactions. And if you start to put in numbers, you will actually find in this case that the numbers look much better than what you have in the case of the corresponding counterpart in the case of the light. And then you can do a similar argument. I don't really want to go through this now in all detail between atoms 3 and so on. You can implement the whole teleportation protocol. Again, you can work out the fidelity for all of these things, and it turns out that if you put in relatively realistic numbers, you find that fidelities, for example, for this should be actually very close to 1. So we believe that from an experimental point of view, this should work quite well. And if you talk about noise and imperfection in a system like this, for example, there would be propagation noise that can be modeled by a beam splitter that we put in here. Again, we have done the corresponding calculations, and we believe that this whole system is actually fairly noise tolerant. Now, I mentioned before that Eugene Polzig in Aarhus, he has done an experiment that will be published in Nature, I think, in the next week or something like that. He has essentially implemented the first part of the scheme. So he has shown in the experiment that by making these measurements of this operator B, of these polarization fluctuations, you essentially project the atomic ensembles into these EPR states that I was talking about here. So I would say that the first part has been demonstrated in an experiment. The second part is still missing, but I hope to some extent that I've sort of given you kind of a flavor to what extent we can use measurements to produce interesting entangled states over some distance, and then to use this, for example, for teleportation. And we have talked here about a case which is fairly exotic. It's not teleporting qubits, it's teleporting a wave function psi of x, a continuous variable state. So, and with this I would like to conclude, and I'm sorry again that I started a little bit late. I wanted to work a little bit more in this talk before I gave it, but I think that I've been more or less in time. Thanks very much.
Questions?
The idea of using small ensembles of atoms as qubits is very ingenious. One thing that struck me is if you couple them to do your qubit gates using the dipole-dipole interaction, then these little blobs of atoms have some finite size, little r, and then they'll be separated by some distance, big r. So you'll get some uncertainty in your interaction, which will go something like little r over big r. So your phase will also have an uncertainty.
That's not the case. And the reason is simply this one. If you go to the limit where you get a dipole blockade, the distance does not really matter. You know, the dipole blockade corresponds to a regime where the Rabi frequency with which I excite has to be less than the dipole-dipole coupling that I get. And so it's a quantitative argument. If I want to be in the limit where the omega, the Rabi frequency, is much, much less than the dipole-dipole shift, the whole thing is completely insensitive to the distance because it's simply larger and it will never excite it, independent of what the distance is to the extent that this is satisfied. So this is, in this sense, fairly fault-tolerant. So this won't occur, what you said about, if you talk about the dipole-dipole blockade. If you would really excite it, truly excite it, okay, then, of course, exactly what you say would happen.
The second question was, if the continuous variable, presumably there is some effect of finite precision in your measurements and carrying out unitary transformation. Obviously, with the state of experiments, this is not going to be a big deal. But you know, what is the effect of the fact that you can only measure, say, your x or your p variables to some finite precision?
Well, this is something, I mean, what we do is an analysis here where we assume that we are quantum noise limited, okay? If you're not quantum noise limited, then this is the end of the game, okay? You cannot talk about teleportation if your measurements are not quantum noise limited. What you're saying is this, that within being quantum noise limited, there's a certain, still an error, of course, in there, and I mean, I think it's, we've not really done this, but I think it's fairly obvious that you have to do simply some averaging over these distributions that you have, you know, of that. I mean, depending how large this error is, I would say if you're much better than quantum noise limited, then this is exactly what the requirement is. And it's just to what extent you satisfy this, you know, you will be quantum or not. So I wouldn't know off the head exactly what these numbers are that, you know, would be relevant for experiments here.
Thank you. After you produce entangled states of many spins, how long do they live?
In the atomic ensembles here? I think that the lifetime is more like something like, I don't know, milliseconds, I think. One should be more careful here. We, of course, the theoretical understanding is this, that if I would ask myself what's the reason that entanglement would decay, I would ask myself what's the dominant decoherence mechanism. And the dominant decoherence mechanism for the atoms would be collisions among each other that destroy this polarization. And it's my understanding that this is on the millisecond timescale. And if I take this, as based on my theoretical understanding, as an estimate for the entanglement, that this is also the timescale where this would be destroyed. It's very similar to say, light squeezing. When you have light squeezing, you also look at the losses that you have, and you talk about squeezed light propagation, which exactly determine to what extent you're still squeezed or not. And this is just the counterpart, which is an atomic spin squeezing that we have here. So the situation should be completely analogous, and I'd argue milliseconds.
Initially assumed this was really purely polarized, so in the X direction. How realistic is that in the experiment? I mean, that seems to be...
Making a pi over 2 pi. This is the easiest part. I think even I could do this, yes. I think that, no, I mean, pi over 2 pi, this is extremely...
The atomic ensemble starts out initially as all the atoms in this superposition 0, 1 to the end.
You are saying again that you want to be quantum noise limited. I mean, it has to be looked like this. You got your Bloch vector here. The Bloch vector is proportional to the number of atoms. You got the uncertainty ellipse out here. And the uncertainty ellipse out here is essentially square root over n noise down. So the radius is square root of n, the number of atoms, and the length is n. So the relative noise, phase noise, would be 1 over square root of n. So you have to make an experimental decision in preparing these things that the accuracy of your Bloch vector, you know, is within this quantum noise limit. So you want to be quantum noise limited in the preparation.
Okay. but that's...
This is what they are able to do. Yes, I think so, yes. It depends on the number of atoms that you take. So if you take a Bose-Einstein condensate, typically these experiments that they are set up at the moment would not be able to do it because they're not set up to do that. But there's no reason why not. It's just hard work. It's not trivial. Yeah.
So if you take optical pumping, Bose experiment?
Yes, yes, right.
In this case, the collision time, of course, it depends on the density because it depends on this collision. Mm-hmm. But it does not depend on the total number of atoms.
Well, the total number, you talk about now the total number of atoms, meaning the total number was very important because it entered the parameter kappa that we had, you know. Right. And this parameter scaled with the number of atoms. This is the sensitivity of squeezing to noise. And I mean, what we know in the case of photons, I mean, the same thing applies also here. Okay.